Hey everybody, welcome to Space Force. I'm your host, Jason Tondro.
I'm Jim.
And I'm Ace. Hello.
And we are here for Sukal, the 11th episode of the third season of Discovery. And we are rapidly hurtling towards the season finale. Now that we've dealt with the Mirror Universe and Giorgio, it looks like things are coming to a cliffhanger-y conclusion. Discovery goes into this nebula where there's an entire planet of dilithium. And after some early scouting by Book in his like weird detached ship that can like fly apart into different pieces but then come back together again, they eventually discover that there's one person still alive down there, and we figure out that it is the child of the woman that we saw in a couple of episodes previous, that the Kelpian woman that we saw had a baby, and that child is still alive on the planet somehow, but has never encountered anybody in many decades. And so Saru and Culber and Burnham go down to the planet, or the ship, the Kelpian ship. And then Tilly takes command, and they go and they guard the outside of the nebula, basically. They got to get their shields built up and repair all the damage from going in the nebula the first time, so they can go in and rescue the away team the second time. Well, naturally, the Emerald Chain shows up with our adversary for the season. What's her name again? She's kind of forgettable to me.
Osha or something like that? Yeah. Oasha?
Osira, isn't it?
Something like, oh, yeah, there you go.
Osira.
Osira shows up with her ship, and there's some cat and mouse there, which eventually ends up with her taking over Discovery. Meanwhile, back on the ship, the away team is getting radiation poisoned pretty quickly. They've got like hours to get their mission done. And they just, 4 hours. And they discover that the kid, who's now a grown-up, of course, has basically been raised by the holodeck, or by this very, very expansive holo platform, which appears to fill like the entire ship. And he's been raised by these holograms, which have been failing from the radiation and everything. And so he doesn't really know what people are, and he thinks everything outside the ship has been is dead and destroyed, and he starts to panic. And we start to discover what the burn is, and we'll talk about that once we get into the episode. It ends up with Burnham goes back to Discovery, or she gets picked up by Book, and Discovery gets taken by the Emerald Chain back to Starfleet headquarters.
With a bunch of jumper cables.
With jumper cables. Yeah, exactly. But Book and Burnham are out there on Book's ship. Culber and Saru are still on the planet, in the Kelpian ship. Adira comes to them to help them out with radiation meds. And everybody's split up, and things are looking pretty bad at the end of this episode. What did you guys think, Aid?
As episode, okay, fine, right, yeah, we've seen this kind of thing before. Seen the mystical stuff going for answers to questions that have been season long. Not really satisfied with a lot of that. There's some real ropey stuff going on here, and just so many questions about why did the holodeck do this? Why did that? There was a laugh out loud minute I had right at the beginning of the episode as well.
What's that? Tell us that.
Okay, so the laugh out loud minute when I laughed so much was right at the beginning, where they say that they've got the I think it is Kelpia that's actually being surrounded by the Emerald Chain and then getting a bit concerned. And then they find out that this signal's got Kelpin on it, and they're going to go to there. And Burnham kind of goes, oh, my God, you can't send Saru. He might be all impulsive and such. And I think, my God, what are you talking about? You are literally the most impulsive officer on that ship, and you're worried about how Saru's going to act.
Yeah.
Utter ridiculousness.
A little pot calling the kettle black.
Yeah. So I just laugh so much.
That Saru might be emotionally compromised.
Exactly.
Unlike Burnham. Yeah.
But, I think I can see where this is going. I don't know if it's gonna stick landing again as usual. You know, we're in that final innings, we're in that ninth inning stretch, and you know, are they gonna make it?
I like the episode.
Yeah.
I think in terms of season three episodes that don't feature the male universe and or Joel Joe or the City of the Age of Forever.
Yeah.
I think this was one of the better efforts. It was more character driven.
Right.
The answer to the question for me was unexpected, which is always a delight. When it's something I hadn't thought of, but it's still very much it's steeped in the milieu of what Star Trek does.
You're talking about what is the burn?
Yes, what is the burn? I'm talking about the child and him having a temple tantrum resulting in the destruction of you know, all dilithium crystals.
Yeah.
And it also gives me an emotional reasoning that's not just, I need to fix the timeline because I don't like it. Now it's, I need to fix the timeline to maybe save a child and his mother. And for me, that's enough of an emotional hook.
Do you still think it's going to be a...
The trailer for the next episode, she is talking to someone, presumably Book, and she says, I'll see you again in another distant future.
You don't think...
probably the last time I'm going to see you in another distant future.
You don't think that she's just saying goodbye to Book?
No, I think they're going to use the City of the Edge of Forever. The crew is going to travel, and the ship's going to go the long way to get back to the same point in time.
God, I hope you're wrong.
And they've already shown that molecules themselves want to tail themselves apart, and that's how we degrade the Discovery. To get it to mint condition. To
what the condition is. Yeah.
I'm telling you, money. I'll put money on this.
I can tell. All right. Well, I like the episode. I thought it felt very original series to me. The bridge crew being thrown into this strange situation where they had to sort of figure out the ground rules. You know, it felt like the OK Corral episode or even Shore Leave. You know, it felt like one of those situations, or the Trelane episode, where like, okay, everything is so weird and we have to sort of figure out the ground rules to the situation that we're in and then learn how to win in those new ground rules.
The actual kind of acting, the characters, the actual kind of situation was interesting. It was the reasoning behind some of it that just made me go, okay, why? And then you go, okay, right, carry on. And then, yeah, there was things.
So I like that. Of course, the big surprise at the beginning of the episode was seeing Doug Jones out of makeup, right? Like that was sort of the big reveal of the episode, was Doug Jones as a Saru as a human. This was I loved seeing that, but it blows my Lieutenant Doug Jones theory out of the water.
As soon as he showed up, I thought exactly that. I thought, oh, well, there you go. You revealed him now. You can't pick another character.
But I do think that Saru's time on the show is coming to an end. I really feel like it's hurtling towards... I'm not sure how that'll happen, like whether Saru will end up staying with his going back to his home planet, or whether he'll die a martyr to save everyone or something. But
I thought with Culber and him staying there, I thought that was literally going to be their wave goodbye episode. And then obviously Adira jumped in. You think, okay, they're not going to get rid of three characters in one go.
Well, and that's true. They won't kill Culber again.
Yeah.
Well, I have a theory.
Okay, what's going on. Does it involve time travel?
Well, no, it does not involve time travel. So, A, you get the surprise of Doug Jones showing up, and this must be like the happiest day of his life. Like, he doesn't have to show up to the makeup jail for 3 hours.
He did an interview about this on IO9 where he talked about it. Yeah. And it was very interesting because he was like, well, on the one hand, yes, exactly what you're saying. He was like, I don't have to show up 3 hours early. I don't have to have like all this makeup applied to my face. But on the other hand, how are the fans going to react when they see me? Like, they're going to think that I'm ugly, or they're going to think that I'm, you know, like I'm not serene. Well,
Doug Jones is a beautiful human being inside, yeah, outside of makeup. And they gave him the sidebones. They gave him the TOS sidebones on his
hairpiece. Yeah.
He was Saru.
And he still walked like Saru as well, which I thought was really cool.
That's what we talked about in the interview, was that because finding out how to physically be Saru as a human was a real challenge, because the hoof boots that he's in as Saru really affect the whole way he stands and walks. They push his hips forward and everything. And so when he's in regular shoes, he had to kind of find a whole new way of walking that still evoked Saru, but was actually very different.
Yeah.
He described that he wanted to glide around like a supermodel, but he had to sort of figure out how to do it.
It's just the arm wave he has. Like, okay, that's the guy.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, Jim, I interrupted you.
That's all right. So each character winds up becoming a different race.
Yes.
Right? We get and those legitimate like cosmetic reasons. You don't want to take a handsome man like Hugh Coble and put a whole bunch of Klingon makeup on him.
Right.
But they made him Bajoran.
Yeah.
And what Bajoran's known for? They're known for their spirituality. So he sort of embodies the soul of the team.
Yeah.
They made Bonham a Trill, and whole role in the episode, whole role on the holodeck program, was to serve as a connection.
Yeah.
To connect the child to these concepts of the outside world and to reconnect and experience social dynamics.
Yeah.
And then you have Saru as a human. And while on one hand, it's a daring visual choice because he is the alien character.
Yeah.
But it's also, I think it's because he's going to have to make the action choice. He's going to have to make a decision. And so far, Saru has been awful at making decisions.
Right.
Like every turn, he's always somewhat slightly wrong.
Yeah.
Like if Bonham's always right, like Saru is almost invariably always wrong because he's always sort of positioned opposite him.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And in Star Trek, the human characters have typically been the protagonists of the show, typically have been the protagonists of the universe. Like, there's no Federation without Earth. Like, the Vulcans acknowledge that in Enterprise. Everyone sort of acknowledges, like, it's humanity's desire to build community that is what creates these larger, you know, senses of family. Yeah. And I think Saru has to embody that to reach out to this child who's still very much a danger to the universe unknowingly.
Yeah, because I found that very strange, because I thought, well, why in the world would you make the one Kelpian not look like a Kelpian? I mean, surely the kid would have been.
This is my problem with the old holodeck thing.
Yeah, like surely he would have responded well to a fellow Kelpian.
Oh, it's been 125 years that the only Kelpian he's interacted with has been an old man.
Yeah.
So maybe seeing a younger, you know, leading role character would have shocked him.
Man, maybe.
This is the thing with the holodeck, though. The idea that they've created this holodeck, his mother created a holodeck program, right? So she's sitting there with her computer in front of her. Right, what am I going to do? Okay, I've got the potential to create any environment I want to. What can I do? Right, I could do very similar, like Leah Brahms in Next Generation. I could effectively recreate myself so that he can live his entire life and never know that I have died because I am there. Or I can create some gothic horror story. Yep, that's the thing I'm going to do. It's like, why did you just not put yourself in it? And he could have lived and he could have died and he would have never known the difference. Instead, you decided to give him some bizarre, hey, defeat this monster, then we'll let you out story. It's like, why the hell did you do that?
I guess I figured that that's not how it went down. I guess I assume that. Now, you're right. She could have created a version where she herself was still in it and they could have just gone total immersion. But she presumed that the kid was going to get rescued. And so her goal was to teach the kid and nurse him along until that rescue was going to happen. And she thought that was like a week away, not not 100 years away, right?
Yeah, you could have still dealt with other people. You could have had other stuff. I just think the environment for again, this is where the thing, the idea, if this was a planet or a pseudo dimensional realm they travel to, yeah. Okay, the idea this was created by somebody just seems utterly bewildering to me.
I thought the Gothic stuff was all just because the computer program was falling apart. I thought that was a symptom of its destruction by the radiation. I don't know.
Well, it was obviously made after the storybook. Like, right, the storybook is sort of like the touchstone. So she creates this. She has a 5-week old child. She's dying. She creates this holodeck program that's supposed to be for a kid, and she peoples it with a whole bunch of people because she Starfleet people. Because she knows that the people to rescue my child are going to be wearing Federation uniforms. So I need to build that trust in.
Yeah.
And I need to give him some survival skills. So he mentions that he has these tests. Like, I actually think the Gothic thing, to your point, Jason, is because the program is so old and now it's just breaking down everywhere.
Yeah.
I did love the fact that when Bonham fell, the safety protocols were on and she zooms and she flies all the way to the fortress.
Yeah.
Like, I love that. Like, for a second there, I'm like, well, that's silly. I'm like, oh no, that's just what the holodeck safety protocol is in, you know, post JJ Abrams track. And I kind of loved it for that.
My favorite bit of the whole holodeck scene is when Burnham, I thought that it really showed Burnham's intelligence off well, where she realizes, oh, like the rule of this is that he thinks we're all holograms. So I'll pretend to be a hologram and be able to talk to him. And then so it's like, you're a hologram. And she's like, yes, I'm a hologram. And I like that. I thought that it showed Burnham's intelligence. And then when he reboots the program and she has to pretend to reset herself, that's Burnham doing method acting. And I loved that. I thought that was smart.
I actually really enjoyed Bonham this episode.
Yeah.
It's like I like the character of Michael Bonham. I just don't necessarily know if I like season 3 Michael Bonham.
Oh, yeah.
But this character, well, she does use her intelligence.
Yeah.
Like, her acting is, you know, on point.
Of course.
And just that little hello. just that little pause. Like, that was just so great. Like, I really appreciated Michael in this episode.
Yeah. Green is an amazing actress. And as much as I sometimes resent the fact that her character is always right, she always delivers emotionally. Yeah, for sure.
And everyone got to, like, everyone of the main cast got to do something. Book got to be the action hero. He even got the Riker wink.
My
wife really responded to, like, ooh. And I was actually surprised the episode wasn't directed by Jonathan Frakes, because I'm like, that's a Frakes moment. You know, Tilly gets the chair sequence.
Yeah.
You know, they even call back to Joel Joe in a way that I felt was not ham-fisted.
So can we talk about Captain Tilly for a minute?
Yeah.
What do you guys think of the Captain Tilly sequence? Like, how'd she do? Or did you like the scene or how it was presented?
She seemed to fit. It worked.
Yeah.
So like you were saying about the idea of having the little burr there to kind of, bring you back to the moment kind of thing to make decisions. Yeah. But it was quite nice to actually see her and not kind of literally just fall apart as soon as the first bit of conflict going on. Because that's the worst thing you'd want to do to is build her up. It's like, oh, you're going to be the best captain ever. And oh my God, it's all gone wrong. She actually just stands her ground and just, bluffs her way out of it kind of thing and kind of gives everything back she's kind of given. If Saru goes, are we going to see Captain Tilly be the proper captain? Are we going to see Burnham? I mean, it'd be interesting.
It's got to be Captain Burnham in first officer.
It's got to be. But, she did well.
You know what I found really interesting with that first bit with her, like, in the captain's chair? Now, first off, let's talk about the whole, like, burr underneath the chair thing. This is such a weird retcon. I find it fascinating because now everyone will have to go in and write fan fiction about the time Jim Kirk used the burr on the underside of the captain's chair, it's fascinating to me. I love what they were going for here. The idea, like, okay, I'm going to fill you in on the secret that only other Starship captains know. Here's the thing that only the people that have sat in the chair know, and it's the thing that binds everybody that's ever sat in the chair. I totally get what they were going for. I found the burr kind of silly, though. Like, it didn't really land for me. I don't know why. Maybe it was because we went out and we saw the picture from underneath. Okay, that's not like an accidental mechanical malfunction of the way that the chairs are produced. That's a fucking sphere, like, stuck to the bottom of the armrest. I think they
overstretched it a little bit by saying it was also a similar fault on the shins on as well. It's like, why are you telling me someone's not fixed this yet?
Yeah. Now, on the other hand, I can totally see the captains of Starfleet saying, no, you cannot fix that. That's the thing that the captains of Starfleet share, and I am countermanding every manufacturing order to fix it. Right? Like, I can totally see the captains of Starfleet doing that. But anyway, what I loved about it was when they put her in the chair and there's a ship coming and it says it's a Federation starship, it was Wrath of Khan. It's the exact same moment when Kirk sees the Reliant coming and everyone's like, okay, it's the Reliant, but it's acting all weird. And he's like, well, yellow alert, I guess. Right? And she figures it out, right? She's like, well, that's because that's not a Federation starship. And she figured, and we see her figuring it out. She's like, well, where's the nearest Class M planet? Like, it doesn't, if we presume it doesn't have warp capability because it's out of dilithium, it couldn't have come from anywhere. So she figures it out. And I love that. I love that was a little bit, you know, I wouldn't have fallen for Khan's trick from Wrath of Khan kind of moment. Jim, what did you think of Captain Till?
So those these episodes of the original series where they put Scotty in the central seat, right?
Oh, yeah.
And it's either the Enterprise is going to crash into the, like in the Apple, the Enterprise is going to crash into the planet, or, you know, he has to stave off Klingons in like season 3 episode. Yeah. And it felt very much like that, where the dialogue was not polished.
Yeah.
Like, they... And Tilly's dialogue this episode is really strange.
Interesting.
I watch it with the TV on. And Tilly's always been a more like, whole dialogue is not Captain Pike's dialogue. It's not, we are going to do this. It's, we're going to do this.
Yeah.
You know, those slight ticks in the dialogue. In this episode, she has that awful line that Mary Wiseman delivers like a pro.
Which is,
well, you know, you're not living. Like, it's like what my old grandma Adela used to say. You're not living unless you've driven a starship into a fiery nebula of radiation and gotten everyone out safe. That's an awful line of dialogue. That is like Lucas level overwriting.
That's funny.
And she delivers it with such aplomb that we pause the episode just to be like, good job. Like,
I laughed when she said it. I thought it was funny.
It is a funny line, but just the construction of the sentence is so, there's so many, like, that is a Jim overwriting line.
Right.
Like, if I know one thing, it's when something's being overwritten.
Now, for those that are not listening, or don't know this, I give Jim shit all the time. I used to. It's actually, you don't do this anymore. Your writing style has really changed. But you used to be famous for overwriting stuff, over-dramatizing.
Yeah, I think it's when I'm unsure of the story, I override it.
Oh.
Yeah. So that line of dialogue was really clunky. And when she was forcing the captain's chair and she was saying, not going to happen, and giving all that sass, I'm like, it doesn't really fit in the captain's chair. Then I had to remind myself, no, Scotty was in there and he like bluffs the Klingons the same way.
Okay.
Like,
okay.
Scotty's giving almost the exact same lines of dialogue. So, you know, maybe that's latent sexism in my part to be questioning. I think it's also the rank. The fact that she's an ensign and those lieutenant commandos standing around her, like Nielsen, that still kind of throws me off. But for the most part, I actually liked her whole bit. I thought the line about invoking Sigmund Freud was a little much.
Yeah, the projection bit.
Yeah, like the projection is great, but I just think the road it took to get there was a little long.
Yeah.
I think that's the... Maybe that's because Tilly's unsorted herself, and so she's doing the thing that she does, which is oval talk.
She does seem to be kind of like over talking, but kind of bolstering herself and bluffing slightly. It doesn't sound like she's not acting naturally. She's just not doing a kind of, you know, Kirk just says, hey, everyday discussion. If you're sitting in the chair, out the chair, she seems, as soon as you sat in that chair, she takes on like the captain's must act like this, so I must talk like that. So that's the kind of thing, yeah.
There's this, it reminds me of this interesting bit where Christopher Reeve was talking about playing Superman in Donner's film. And he said, look, the trick to playing Superman is never stand there with your fists on your hips. Like, never do that. Let the costume do that for you. Just walk around like an ordinary person, because the costume will do all the superhero lifting for you. And Tilly is putting her fists on her hips. She's like acting like a captain instead of just being Tilly in the captain's chair. Yeah, that's very interesting.
And I can see, you know, with time and character development,
yeah,
I can see her becoming a captain and becoming a good captain.
Yeah.
But I don't believe Bonham's line, like we made a joke about it earlier, that the what makes a good captain a captain is the objectivity.
Right.
And I don't believe that is something that Star Trek has ever told us.
Oh, yeah.
And literally, they're telling us with Tilly, she's going to be a great captain because she does everything out of love. If you do everything out of love, you're not objective.
Right.
Yeah. It's not an objectivist thought.
No, I agree with you. And I think that actually every time they've had an objective captain, it's ended in disaster. Right. So, yeah.
Yeah. The objectivity is what brought us Nazis on that planet.
Right.
Objectively, well, the Nazis were the strongest nation on Earth in the shortest amount of time. So I'm going to introduce Nazism here, and I'm wrong.
Yeah, yeah, I'm just wrong. But Tilly's time in the captain's chair ends with a failure, ends in defeat. The Emerald Chain comes in, and I have to acknowledge, like, okay, the Emerald Chain is very on brand. Like, they have a lot of very good branding going on here. They not only do we already see slave collars in a previous episode, but now they have like little slave helmets that they put on Stamets, and even their starship, as you noted, Jim, like reaches out with cable to like wrap chains around the Discovery. Like, these guys, they know their marketing shtick, and they are sticking with it. What's your thoughts on the whole Emerald Chain as antagonists and in this episode, Abe?
They're talked about, but they're not seen to do much. We've seen, oh my god, they're on the border of the thingy. Oh my god, they've got, and it's like, yeah, what have they done? Or were they're running this thing? Okay, great, they're helping people out for a price. Okay, yeah, that's probably not the greatest thing to do, but they're not doing anything dramatically damaging. Yeah, if they could be got rid of, or you know, compromise so they could help be brought into the Federation, because again we were already seeing that they are Andorians in there, so it should be like, well, you were members of the Federation, why don't you come back? But the idea they kind of like, I'm gonna, again, it's the shaking fists bit bad guy, I'm gonna steal your spaceship and have it for my own. You go, what are you gonna do with it then? I don't know, but I'm gonna have it. what was the plan? Tell me something you're gonna do with a spore drive that's gonna be dramatically important, and then I will give a crap about them taking it.
Well, I think the Emerald Chain's overall metaphor is slavery, right? They're essentially a slave race, a slave takers.
Yeah,
and they make the prisoners work as slaves. They force Stamets to mind control him, and they're the Emerald Chain, right? And so they're maybe that slave taking hasn't been suitably impressed upon us in the season, but that seems like what the goal was.
Because I mean, we obviously saw the one episode with Booker being taken aboard, and he was obviously relegated to that position. But when they were first introduced in the very first episode, there were trade organization that just happened to be doing stuff. It's like, so they've kind of, I don't know whether they've decided to change the way they were going to do, or they were always going to be the big bad or whatever. And I can kind of see that the idea that they've now got Starfleet headquarters' coordinates, because obviously had that invisible force field around it, they're going to sweep in and try and destroy that or whatever they're going to do.
Yeah.
I'm still waiting, like Jim said previously, that Starfleet are not going to be the shining example anyway, and we're going to see some kind of, aha, we fought you off the original, and now we're going to finish the job because you're evil, Starfleet. We were the good guys all along. And I think that's going to happen. But I don't know. I mean, yeah, they're okay. They're not great. They're not Klingons. Yeah, they're not to that standard. So
yeah. Jim. Heavy sigh.
Yeah. Heavy sigh. Yeah. I like this episode. I want to make that clear. Like, the episode ended, and I was like, you know what? It's not JoJo. Like, it's not that deep into character, but it gave me a scene where, you know, someone rolled really high on their singing check. Yeah. Like, it gave me a scene where characters acknowledge, yeah, this is going to be a big deal for you, Saru. Like, this is going to be emotionally, like, seeing a Kelpian in space for Saru is a huge step.
It is, yeah. Sure.
And then seeing this as a lost child. So there's a lot of, like, everything to do with the away mission I was on board for, everything with Book, like, just give that man his spinoff TV show and I'll be happy.
Okay. All right.
Give me like 6 hours of him just like bombing around, winking at people with his cat.
That time. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But when it comes to the Emerald Chain, it just feels like the necessary evil to establish the Federation's heel turn.
Okay.
So how does, you know, the only people they contact is Admiral Vance. I think we're going to have a situation where Vance was using the barbarians on the outside of the Empire, outside of Rome, to control the other populations to try to get stability, and that's why there was the Cold War in effect.
Okay.
And Discovery throws that off.
So Vance was using the threat of the Emerald Chain to keep the Federation together.
Mm-hmm.
And now with the, so he actually wants the Emerald Chain to continue to exist, because without it, his power is threatened.
Yeah. And I think it's going to be a situation where, you know, there's going to be the double cross, right? There's going to be the double cross of Osiris is like, I have the big weapon. And, you know, she's going to try to pull a fast one in Vance, but not before we find out like Vance's crimes. And I like Vance. I think if you're going to do it, I'd still go with Cronenberg, because he's still in the background and Cronenberg's always creepy.
Why Cronenberg took that job, by the way. He's trying to produce some of his own films, so he needs money.
Yeah.
So he took the job for the paycheck, which I find fascinating. Yeah.
He fits, though. He's still good.
Well, that's a very Roddenberry thing to do.
You're right.
Roddenberry wrote a lot of bad television just because he needed a check, because he wanted to fund his other projects. He wanted to, you know, start producing, you know, this Star Trek passion project he had.
Well, I'm the naive guy that still thinks Vance might turn out to be okay. But I do think that we're going to solve. I don't think we need time travel to get out of our current situation. We've got a planet full of dilithium. So if the Federation can get that, they can use it to start rebuilding the Federation. And I think at some point somebody even says something like that, like, well, the Federation could sure use that right now, you know, kind of comment. We've circled the wagons on the time travel solution many times, but we'll see how that all plays out.
I'll put one more piece of information. I'll just call back to the fact that they introduced Star Trek's first transsexual actor and character, and killed them off before we met them.
Yeah.
Time travel allows you to undo that, and so that Stamets doesn't run around looking like a crazy person at memorial services.
What do you mean by that? You
Oh, when he has that moment where he acknowledges, like, Adela makes the verbal, like, recognition that Gray is standing there, they cut to that shot where they, you know, Gray steps out, and Stamets goes, now, we're at a memorial service, so I'm not going to give you my piece of my mind, but I'm really cross with you, and he walks off.
Yes.
He looks like a crazy person in that moment.
Right.
And and the Anthony Rapp can act the hell out of that scene. I just think that is going to get old hat really quickly.
Exactly. I think that situation, they're going to have to do something with it to resolve it at some point, because the idea that, like, kind of Gray was hanging around purely as some kind of, like, latent memory thing, okay, that could be one thing. But now he's got opinions and he doesn't like being left alone because he can't interact with the real world anymore. And you're thinking, what the hell are they going to do with this? So, yeah, like you say, bringing them back as via time travel, that's a possibility. I don't know, but there's something going to go with it.
Adira is certainly being set up to have kind of their hero moment next episode, to save Culber and possibly Saru. and the child to, and do Trill for some reason have some resistance to radiation? Is that just me remembering that, or that?
No, they were highly susceptible to spidal venom. So I don't know how strong they would be against radiation.
And don't forget, Adira is actually human anyway, so the symbiote might help. But I've got there's a thing I've got to mention about this as well, about the whole Adira thing, right? This it's technical niggling stuff again. It's nitpicky little things, but it's just stuff like, okay, fine, right. Discovery must still have a transporter room to transport equipment and to transport people that haven't got them. But she had to borrow somebody else's badge to transport down onto Book's ship and then away again as well, right?
Yeah.
Neelix, for Christ's sake, had a comms badge. Why have they not give one to Adira? It makes no sense. Give him a comm badge. Give him.
As you complain about that, my comm badge falls off.
Yeah, there you go. See? There you go. But the idea they had to borrow a comm badge, it's like, you've been a member of the crew for months now. Just give them one. It makes no sense. I think, before they teleported off and did their kind of heroic, I'm going to solve this, I literally thought, Culber and Saru, that's the last we're going to see of them. They're out of it. And then the Deer goes, no, I'm jumping in as well. I'm thinking, no, we're not. That's it. You're not getting rid of three characters like that. I think we're going to see them all coming back in the last episode and saving the day. And either Saru's going to die in the process or he's going to go off afterwards. I think it's going to happen. Yeah.
But I found it interesting. I actually liked the plot development that the Emerald Chain was besieging the Kelpian homeworld. That felt like a smart move. That felt like something that a manipulator like Osyra would do. She knows the captain is a Kelpian, so I'm going to threaten the Kelp. I don't know much else about him, so I'm going to threaten the Kelpian planet in order to get him to show himself. That felt smart to me. And it made me wonder if that's going to get more play in the two episodes that remain. Are we going to – is that – the Emerald Chain flagship is going to Starfleet headquarters, and from what we saw from next week's episode, if it's any indication, they effectively invade and take over Starfleet headquarters by force. But that still leaves the entire fleet parked outside of the Kelpian homeworld, and I'm wondering if there's going to be some stakes there for Saru, and if that will lead, if we'll get some interaction there, or if that's just like, okay, well, that's why the fleet's not here and we're not going to see the fleet for the rest of these next two episodes because they're busy with that subplot off camera.
Yeah, so again, the idea, this also is something that niggled me a little bit about the nebula itself.
Yeah.
Book mentions, there's a transwarp tunnel that kind of passes by, but no one really wants to go there because it's pointless. You go, okay, fine. Right.
I thought it was too dangerous.
Yeah, well, whatever. Dangerous, pointless, not interesting. Anyway, so theoretically, the Emerald Chain cut starship is using transwarp to get from A to B, so that's why they can make the jump so quickly. Okay.
Yeah.
But when they first found out about the nebula itself, they immediately knew kind of where it was in location to when they triangulated it, they knew what it was. They kind of gave it a name. They knew what it was called. They managed to find a signal. That nebula there, again, because this is the thing about the burn as well. We thought, obviously, it's a trapped spaceship. It's going to be a Kelvinverse ship. It's going to be an alternate time dropped discovery. It's going to be mirror universe discovery. Now it's a normal ship. It's next to a planet of dilithium. Scatman's not gone in that nebula before now and found that planet.
Yeah.
I mean, they know it's there. They give it a location. They give it a name. If it's just like no one decided to just poke in there and have a look over all their hundreds of years.
I think it's just too dangerous.
Well, maybe.
And when the Discovery can only go in there for like a minute before they've got to leave.
So. But again, if Book hadn't flown in, I would have allowed. If you literally have to teleport through it.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. Right. Discovery can jump in. Okay, that kind of negates any previous Next Generation crew, doesn't it? But Book flies through it and dies. Or, you know, could have died on the other side. Yeah. So the idea, if there was just some records of some other ships that they tried and they were saying, that'd be something as well. At least someone had a go at it. That'd mean that good. But when they do this stuff that's set thousands and thousands of years in the future and you come along and go, oh, well, no one knew this was here. And you go, how? How did they know this? Literally the entire Alpha and Beta Quadrant are mapped out and you still didn't know this was here?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
Thoughts, Jim?
I love your nitpicking, Aid.
I know. It just niggles me.
I go back to Next Generation, and Next Generation, the very first, you know, to your point with Adela's comm badge, I agree. They gave Wesley a comm badge, and he was just, even before he was acting ensign, he had one. So, like, if they're going to give it to a preteen, you might as well give it to another preteen, or a teenager, I should say.
Yeah.
Next Generation, like the very first few episodes of Next Generation, they do a really good job of establishing that the universe is vast and we've only really charted like 16% of the galaxy.
Right.
Like, even though we, you know, like they establish that like the Enterprise is going off into the great uncharted mass of the galaxy. Like, that's their mission in episode one.
Yeah.
And they sort of, they don't quite continue with that through line, whereas different showrunners show up and they take the ship back to Earth and they take the ship back to Klingon homeworld. But for the most part, I'm willing to suspend my disbelief that while we say it's a quadrant, they don't have the entire quadrant mapped out. And maybe they just have a section of the quadrant that's densely populated, because we've had a lot of episodes of TV.
In the immortal words of Douglas Adams, the universe is big. Really big. Yeah.
So the idea that they haven't figured out that there's this one pocket of oil over here in Alaska, and they haven't really gone over there to investigate it, I'm okay with that. Like, that for me wasn't a big deal.
All right. So we have not really talked about the fact that we discovered the cause of the burn this episode. And it was not anything related to Burnham. It was not related to her time travel shenanigans from last season. It was nothing any of us could have anticipated. Jim, you mentioned this at the beginning of the show, that it kind of comes out from left field. It's unexpected. And to me, this is, that's cool that it's something none of us had anticipated, but it's also kind of unfair, because I kind of wanted a fair play murder mystery where the clues to the burn are actually in the season and you could figure out what it was, like it would make sense. But instead, it's this new self-contained issue where apparently, and I, Aid, in your notes, you were like, okay, what's up with this? Like, how does this work again? What is the origin of the burn again? As I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, this kid is born in the nebula, and there's this weird subspace anomaly going on in the nebula around this dilithium planet. And every cell in this kid's body is somehow linked to subspace. Right. So his emotional and physical state is mirrored in subspace, or can affect subspace. And so when a few years into it, or however long his mother lasts, because they said that like the burn happens like a few years after this ship was lost. So I think he was born and his mother somehow stayed alive for like a few years. And then when she dies, that's his cry of anguish causes the burn. So literally a mother's death and the child's cry of grief causes, it echoes out through subspace and causes every dilithium crystal in an active warp core to explode. Okay, like that's completely wild. It makes no goddamn sense, but it's established as that's how it worked in this episode. And I guess it's no weirder than, you know, reversing the tachyon flow through the deflector dish.
Okay. I loved it. I think, okay, so I totally hear what you're saying about Discovery has a problem presenting itself as a mystery show. Like the full season, they hid the mystery under the Klingon war arc, right? It's like, yeah. So the overarching thing, it wasn't like who is Lorca or who is Tyler. Like those were definitely there.
Yeah.
But for the main thrust of it was war. Season two is entirely a mystery plot.
Yeah.
What's happened? You know, where was Spock?
Yeah.
Why is Spock missing? And why are these signals happening? And we have to investigate this cosmic threat to the universe.
Yeah.
That one, all the pieces of the modal mystery are in that season. Right. And this is the unfair modal mystery. Like, it's a mystery to the characters.
Yeah.
And because we're seeing the show through the character's lens, we get dragged along trying to piece it together ourselves.
Yeah.
to me, this smacks of small Star Trek.
Okay.
And Star Trek's very loose in terms of its science.
Yes. Like,
it's very loose with its science. Magic crystals allow us to travel faster than light.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you can accept that as your starting point,
yeah.
Then why can't you have magic mushrooms that zap you from one part of the universe to the next part?
Yeah.
Because of a tardigrade. So things of a suspension of disbelief. This takes the themes of Star Trek, which is to examine the human condition and makes it big. What is more disruptive in your day-to-day life? If you have a young child and that child is crying, that is the most disruptive thing in your entire day. Yes. And if you can't get the child to stop crying, oh my God, you want to die. So the idea of taking this thing that we all can relate to, we've all been in a room where a child's crying and we're like, oh my God, what do you need? I will give you anything that you need to stop crying.
Yeah.
It's taken that very human sensation and it's just made it big.
That's great.
And made it Trek big.
Well,
I love that.
You sold me. As a metaphor, it works pretty great. Aid, does this help at all?
Yes, you give it a bit more gravitas and a bit more kind of understanding about why anytime any TV series, and I've seen this many times, reverts to magic did it, then I know there's a problem. it's just like, again, they could have breadcrumbed this throughout the series. They could have had some stuff, but the idea it's something we've not seen before, that does niggle me a little bit. It really does. Hmm. Like you say, in the context of the using the nebula and the idea that it affects the actual character, and this happens as well. Whether or not we're actually going to be able to remove that character from the nebula without causing problems, or it's going to shoot this burn off every time it gets annoyed.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going to happen there, but it just I'm disappointed. I am disappointed in the fact that it wasn't one of the other solutions that would have made sense in the context of stuff we've seen previously. The idea that this comes completely from left field, as if you've never seen this before, but this is the reason, and you go, why did the Vulcans think it was this then, that it was them? It's like, well, so you're I don't know. So
I do think it's interesting that Adira is the one who beams down.
Yeah,
because technically any character could have beamed down with the supplies.
But
it's the youngest character on the show.
Yeah.
They're in a quasi-surrogate parental relationship dynamic with Hugh and Paul Stamets. Hugh is now threatened.
Yep.
And we have a child who they have to own their trust. They have to own the trust of the child, this childlike adult, in order to rescue him.
Yeah.
And it's Adira who shows up. Yes, they show up with the medical supplies to extend their lives.
Right.
But more importantly, they're showing up with the knowledge of what it means to be lost and finding comfort in strangers.
Right, right. And for Sukal himself, who identifies as a child, he's going to find it easier to relate to Adira than to a lot of other characters. And this becomes Adira's kind of big hero moment, right?
It'd be interesting to see what race Adira appears as in the program as well. Whether or not she appears as a Kelpin or something, that'd be interesting.
I imagine she's going to appear as a Trill to help foster that relationship between Hall and Gray.
Yeah.
Between them and Gray. Apologies.
Yeah. And also Culber as well, because Culber's technically a Trillian there as well. So that's quite interesting. Yeah.
Culber's Bajoran.
Bajoran, sorry, wrong way around, yes.
Yeah, he's got the sexy earring too. Yeah. Like, it was very difficult this episode for me.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. I'm still completely puzzled why they did it. Why they go like, okay, everybody, you're going to be a Trill for this episode.
I'm pretty sure the only reason to do it is to get Saru out of makeup.
Yeah, because that's exactly my thought. I thought, okay, but again, because this came to, as you were kind of watching through the episode, the idea that he gets to be out of makeup, we get to see his actual face, and as it kind of gets near the end of it, you see like, okay, this is Saru's last episode. He's going to stay and look after the kid. You're thinking, this is why they gave him the idea to be out of makeup, so you can actually see this guy. And then that just falls apart, and thinking, why then? If it was like, okay, we're going to pick a Trill or a Bajoran and this kind of stuff, so right, fine. But there's also humans in that lineup of Starfleet people. There's Vulcans in that lineup. It's like, why could Burnham just not be human? If you're going to replace the Kelpin with a human, why does Burnham have to change? It's such a weird thing.
I think it's holodeck damage.
Yeah. Maybe. I was really disappointed that Burnham wasn't a Klingon.
Yeah.
I really just kind of like, I know we're not going to deal with Klingons in Discovery again. Like, the show has really distanced themselves from even mentioning Klingons. Like, I think they show up on like a display screen in one of the Admiral scenes in this season. Mm-hmm. But I was really hoping that she'd show up as a Klingon, because I saw Saru out of makeup with the pointed side bones before I saw the episode. So I knew there was going to be shenanigans.
Shenanigans.
Yeah, it's weird.
Well, we've only got a couple of episodes left this season. What would you guys like to see? How do you want this to end?
See, if we had one more episode, if this was the second from last episode, the idea that we'd see an attack on Starship Fleet Academy or Starfleet Central and Discovery fights them off, da 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 da, I could see that happening in one episode. I don't know what's going to happen in two. I'm completely confused. It's like, okay, well, if that's going to be the last bit, what's going to happen in the next bit? If that's going to be the next bit, what's going to happen in the last episode? Yeah. It's let's say, unless they literally go full on mad time travel but shenanigans and go around and change stuff. And well, I don't know. I honestly do not know where it's going to go.
Jim?
I want Best of Both Worlds Part 1.
Which is okay.
I want a character-driven drama, because you know we all think about Best of Both Worlds and we think of it as the Locutus episode. That's the Borg 2.0. Yeah. The first episode is a Riker episode, and it's a character piece, and it's Riker examining. It's Riker being confronted with his younger self and all the gumption and go-getter-ness that he had for the first two seasons, and realizing, oh, that's not me anymore, and reevaluating his life in relation to his surrogate father figure in Picard.
Yeah.
So I want a character-driven episode that establishes the Federation as the bad guys.
You want them to be the bad guys.
I want them to be the bad guys, because here's why.
Yeah.
Star Trek has trained me, after 50 years of digesting media, Vulcans are trustworthy. And if the Vulcans left, there's something really wrong with the system.
Yeah.
If Vulcans and humans stopped interacting, like, I can understand human selfishness. They really explain that in the People of Earth episode. Yeah. Like, we're looking out for our own interests. We have that happening in Brexit. Yeah. Like, I get that plot point. But you have Vulcans leaving?
Yeah.
There's something fundamentally wrong with your universe. And you can say, well, that's the influence of the Romulans. But I don't think it is, because that the president was really eloquent in saying, like, there was other sins that happened.
And
I want to see, I want that season where we have Burnham, captain of the Discovery, rebuilding the Federation from the outside.
Yeah.
And building a counterfaction to an established power structure.
Interesting. Eight?
Yeah, because say, there is no kind of like, oh my God, how are they going to get out of this situation thing with Book and Burnham? Because like I said before, the established transwarp pathway to where they are, obviously Book's ship uses that, so they can get back to outside the nebula, wherever they need to go. So that we're not going to have, oh my God, how are they going to catch up with Discovery? Because they can do it. Obviously, it might take a little time to get there, but whatever. I think they're going to have to, I hope we see stuff happening more on the Discovery and more with Starfleet than we do with Book and Burnham for the next episode. Because I think with all those characters being captive, and like you say, the idea that the revelation of if they do the Starfleet have been bad all along thing, that doesn't necessarily need to be played out with Burnham there, because I think, like I say, Vance needs time to give a bit of a speech and, you know, it was always meant to be this way, or whatever, yeah, whatever he says. But there's got to be, we can't just have every scene with Burnham in it, which this episode was quite good, because like you said before, everyone gets a little bit different, something different to do. With Burnham on Discovery, we got a lot of stuff with Tilly and obviously Adira and Stamets as well outside there. I really hope, I just hope they stick landing. Like I said before, if they do a cliffhanger at the end, okay. I don't know if they will do that, but I mean, I think I'm hoping for some threads at least to go into next season. Now they know it's coming. but I don't necessarily have to see a completely, oh my God, what's going to happen next cliffhanger.
I desperately want that.
Oh, it'd be brilliant if they did.
Yeah. I desperately want the to be continued and you have to wait a year. So Patrick Stewart has this story that he's famous for telling. Well, they filmed the last episode and Patrick Stewart's contract was coming up. That's the reason why he's assimilated at the end of the episode, because they didn't know if he was coming back.
You're talking about Best of Both Worlds again.
Best of Both Worlds Part 1. They didn't know if Reichel's had filed, if the bull key was going to explode and the show was going to become the Reichel show. That's why it's constructed in that way. That's why Reichel was given all the attention and all the character drama. And after the episode is released, he's sitting in his car at a red light and this family pulls up and this mom rolls down the window.
Yeah.
Rolls down the window furious and says, "You ruined my summer. I don't know what's going to happen." And shouting at Patrick Stewart at this red light.
That's great.
So I kind of want that sort of like not knowing. I think there's a reason that CBS is going full steam ahead with another season of Discovery before Picard. And A, COVID has something to do with that. And the COVID restrictions in Canada versus here in the United States, that has something to do with it. But I'm hoping that there was a narrative construction for it.
Yeah. Well, we'll find out next week. And in the meantime, thanks everybody for watching. We'll be back a week with the penultimate episode. Live long and prosper, everybody. Peace and long life.